This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about how the pandemic is impacting the fishing industry on the Central Coast and beyond.
Are the consumers going to continue to support the local fishermen by buying fish directly off the boat, buying fish directly from the local fishermen, or will they return to, you know, walk into Albertsons and buying the frozen piece of fish that comes from China, Thailand, Indonesia, or somewhere far away? It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Also, we'll hear about a new untext book on the Channel Islands.
Yeah, orcas surfing the bow of your boat glowing rainbows. It sounds like a, you know, something out of a movie, but little things like that just happen out there.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, December 21st, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. There's been strong debate about whether government-imposed shutdowns during the pandemic go too far and unnecessarily harm society and the economy. But some GOP lawmakers in California oppose the shutdowns for another reason, because they say there's no evidence that they reduce COVID-19 cases or spikes. Cap Radio's Mike Haggerty spoke with PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols.
Chris, which lawmakers are making this claim, and what exactly are they saying?
Well, one example is Republican State Assemblyman James Gallagher. He represents the Northern Sacramento Valley, and he made his statement on Twitter the same day that California issued its new regional stay-at-home order, closing several business sectors. He wrote, "Government-imposed lockdowns do not reduce COVID-19 cases or stop spikes."
Who did you speak with to fact-check that statement?
I spoke with Lee Riley. He's a professor and chair of infectious disease and vaccinology at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. And he said the confusion over whether shutdowns work is understandable. States with some of the toughest mandates, like California, are also seeing the biggest spikes. But he also said that Gallagher simply got this wrong, that government restrictions do reduce COVID-19 cases, because they eliminate some of that close contact that leads to the spread of the virus.
But if you really look at the data closely, every time they instituted restrictions, we saw a decrease in the number of cases. It decreased both in number of cases, number of hospitalizations, number of deaths. So they clearly work. The problem is when these restrictions are eased or lifted, that's when we see the resurgence. And this is what people are looking at and saying that the restrictions don't work. And that's absolutely incorrect.
Chris, you followed up with Assemblyman Gallagher to see if he stands by his statement. What did he say?
Well, I told him about our findings, and he said he remains unconvinced, saying he believes the drop in cases is more a correlation and not proof that the shutdowns caused them. Here's what he said.
I think it'd be very difficult for any scientist or epidemiologist to say that the science is clear, because first of all, we've never done these type of lockdowns historically when it comes to pandemics. And so we haven't even had the opportunity to do peer-reviewed scientific research to show that the lockdowns, you know, scientifically worked.
Chris, did you find any scientific studies that have looked at this?
Yes, there are some well-vetted studies on this. One was published last month by the federal government, specifically the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It found that stay-at-home orders in Delaware this spring, when combined with public mask mandates and contact tracing, led to an 82% reduction in COVID-19 cases, plus an 88% drop in hospitalizations and a 100% decline in deaths. And it's important to note that these studies, they also say that success depends on how much the public cooperates with the stay-at-home orders, and that no single strategy is likely to be effective by itself. The mandates have to be combined with masks, hygiene, and people keeping their distance.
In the end, how did you rate Gallagher's claim?
We rated his claim as false.
That was Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols speaking with Mike Haggerty. Read full versions of all fact checks at politifact.com slash California. The United States is one of the world's top importers and exporters of seafood, but the U.S. seafood industry sharply declined in the months following the emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic. A new study by researchers at UC Santa Barbara and others details that drop, and they found targeted federal assistance will be necessary to bring it back. KCBX News' Greta Mart first spoke with two of the researchers and then with a fishing industry representative about this year's shock to the seafood pipeline.
I'm Dr. Easton White. I'm a research associate at the University of Vermont.
And I'm Professor Holly Freilich. I'm an assistant professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Can you just tell me about your study? Why'd you launch this? What was the impetus? And what'd you find?
For us, like a lot of other scientists, we really wanted to think about how COVID-19 was affecting the things we're already looking at. And so we wanted to investigate the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and all the associated social distancing interventions on the entire seafood pipeline. And so this includes everything from production all the way over to consumer consumption. And using data from a bunch of different sources, we showed that fresh seafood was hit hardest, that being due to a lot of the restaurant and seafood market demand being decreased early on in the pandemic. And then we looked at other forms of demand actually increasing in response to that, including community-supported fisheries and other forms of seafood delivery.
Okay, got it. Holly, what's your role? How did you get involved?
So Easton actually reached out to me because we were working on COVID-related questions, because as he noted, lawyers were not doctors, and so we wanted to imply kind of what the way that we think about the world and try to lend some insights into that. So we were kind of working on respective projects in this vein, and we connected in relationship to the United States, because Easton's on the East Coast and I'm here on the West, and we had several other collaborators that we were able to bring together, representing not only wild fisheries, but aquaculture. And that's really where my expertise was brought in, AKA aquatic farming.
Okay. Is there a lot of aquatic farming in California?
There's a fair bit. Yes. Most of it is shellfish. So things like oysters are the big ones, but we also have abalone farm here in Santa Barbara, as well as an offshore mussel farm. So we wanted to get kind of a better understanding of how these different systems are being impacted. And, you know, not surprisingly, if we're talking to somebody who's working in this field, it's pretty data rich on the wild fishery side. And so on the aquaculture side, we really had to resign ourselves to looking at the suite of news articles and other insights that we were getting from people we were connected to in this industry.
Although we saw the restaurant demand drop by about 50% and demand in seafood markets drop by about 30% across the whole US, we saw increases in seafood delivery. They actually tripled, and increases in people searching for seafood recipes online. And so that indicates some alternative modes for people to cook their own seafood or get seafood from restaurants in a different way. And that's what we're really interested in, is some of these changes that might be happening short term that might also stick around long term.
Okay, got it. All right, and I'm gonna ask both of you this question. While doing the study, what most surprised you?
Yeah, sure. So I think something that was most surprising is that as we were evaluating these impacts, there seemed to be a bit of a disconnect between the support that the seafood industry needs and the kind of perhaps less coordinated and direct applications for that support through the federal government. And so we found that there's some issues there that we dive into a little bit on, you know, how can that be remedied into the future? So when the next shot comes down the pipeline, that the seafood sector, aquaculture and fisheries, people and anybody through that supply chain can get the needed support to weather some of this and come out on the other side.
How about you, Easton?
Yeah, I was just going to add two things. One, that as Holly was saying, the seafood industry in the U.S. is a huge industry. So it's about a $200 billion industry across commercial and recreational fishing and seafood in total, and accounts for about 2 million jobs in the U.S. So it's a huge sector. And so that's really getting at the right amount of aid. So that came originally from the CARES Act in the U.S. For how much aid was given out to seafood production and seafood processors, and then thinking about what future aid might look like and if that's enough for to keep fishers and seafood producers afloat. So that's one part of it. The other part that I think is really interesting is that for us, thinking about the pandemic has really just revealed these longstanding stress points in the U.S. seafood industry generally. And thinking about the reliance on imports and exports and the reliance on restaurant sales, and that was makes this particular time susceptible to COVID, but also makes the industry susceptible to other shocks that might be in the future as well. One aspect that I think is important is thinking about the seafood processors and producers and fishermen themselves, and how they're often working in really close confined quarters. And those close confined quarters obviously don't do well with COVID. And so we've seen a lot of outbreaks of COVID in fish processing facilities, for example, or on fishing vessels. And so thinking about how to prioritize individuals in this industry is really important. And so it was really encouraging to see the CDC come out and say that those who work in seafood will be some of those that are prioritized for vaccines, for example, next year.
Yeah, I would say that for people who are interested in thinking about what our future is going to look like for food systems, seafood or otherwise, while COVID has no doubt been a really morbid and upending event to all of us, it also has allotted us the opportunity to see these weak points for things like climate change coming down the pipeline to really help us garner some information that can maybe build in more resilience moving forward. So it isn't just kind of isolated to COVID or health-related things, stressors coming that we are pretty solid and are expecting to come down the pipeline, that we could potentially be ready for that moving forward.
That was University of Vermont ecologist Easton White and UC Santa Barbara professor Holly Freelich speaking about their study of the U.S. seafood industry over the past 7 months. Next, we speak with a fishing industry leader to get more perspective on how this year's extreme challenges are affecting the seafood world. KCBX's Greta Mart has more.
My name is Mike Conroy. I am the executive director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. We are the largest trade group representing commercial fishermen and women along the West Coast. Our membership is comprised of 14 or 15 local port commercial fishing associations, which then are comprised of about 500 to 700 members. So we have a pretty wide and diverse membership that ranges is in the south to Santa Barbara, and then far north as in Washington State.
Got it. Okay, so relative to this study, what are you guys seeing from COVID since March? Are you seeing the same kind of drops?
So to truly gauge the impacts that COVID has had on the commercial fishing industry, especially that along the central coast of California, we started noticing the impacts in January, when China started to close its borders and the ability for us to export to China went away. You know, there were a couple of fisheries, the California spiny lobster fishery, for example, and the Dungeness crab fishery. You know, they noticed an increased lack of demand for their product. So they actually started to feel it. I know guys who participate in the lobster fishery actually stopped fishing around the beginning of February. The season typically ends in March because of the lack of markets. So, you know, at the outset, certainly, especially those fisheries that are dependent upon the export market, they felt the pain loudly, strongly, and deeply. As we moved forward into March, April, and May, we started working with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to try to lessen some of the red tape that's required for fishermen to sell their catch directly to the public, directly off the boat. We fought for and received some temporary increases in groundfish trip limits in order to help the folks dependent upon that fishery to increase their catch and therefore have the ability to keep up with their revenues. So I got to give our state and the department a lot of credit with regards to that and working with the industry to do that. And then when the you know, when we started to see the regulatory and legislative relief efforts that were put forth, CARES Act and things like that, the state worked with us on that as well. So we were able to participate in all of those processes. With regards to the impacts to Central Coast fisheries, as I noted before, I think a lot of it depends upon the fisheries. If you look at the higher volume, lower value fisheries, you know, for example, squid or anchovy, I think that the impacts to those fisheries were more longstanding because they're reliant upon, you know, having markets that can absorb that type of supply. Whereas the more, and I'll use the word artisanal, I don't know if that's the right word, fisheries for salmon, ground fish and whatnot, they were able to quickly adapt their business models and not be so reliant upon either the export market or the restaurant markets, but were able to figure out ways to direct market to folks during the, you know, especially at the outset during the lockdown, when, you know, the beef, the poultry, the pork processing plants were forced to shut down because of COVID concerns temporarily, I'll add. You know, California's commercial fishermen and women were able to deliver fresh seafood directly from the boat to consumers, you know, either to their house or at centralized drop-off points. So I think as we became more and more, and I don't want to say that we became used to the impacts of COVID, but as we learned how to adapt our business models to fit within the realities of COVID, I think that we were able to continue to provide sustainable, locally harvested seafood to California seafood consumers. So I think to that standpoint, it has shown the ability of our folks to adapt and be resilient. And I think one of the points that was highlighted in this article, one of the questions asked really is, you know, to what degree will COVID alter seafood supply chains? And I think that's a very good question. And it will be interesting to see when things return to a more semblance of normalcy, are the consumers going to continue to support the local fishermen by buying fish directly off the boat, buying fish directly from the local fishermen, or will they return to, you know, walk into Albertsons and buying the frozen piece of fish that comes from China, Thailand, Indonesia, or somewhere far away? It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Is there anything else the federal government can do to help the fisheries at this time? Like, was there a specific like policy they could do?
In terms of, you know, federal policies, additional relief, whatnot, the CARES Act, which was passed, I believe, in April, $300 million in that act was earmarked toward commercial fisheries relief. And that 300 mil was spread out amongst the entire nation. And it was distributed based upon relative dependence on commercial fishing income to the various states. California kind of fell in the middle. We got roughly $16 million to distribute amongst the potentially 11,000 permitted commercial fishermen, women, charter boats, and whatnot. At the end of the day, I believe each qualifying applicant under the CARES Act received about $7,000. Now, I don't mean to in any way, shape, or form diminish that or not express sincere gratitude for that, but $7,000 is a drop in the bucket compared to what, you know, the lost opportunity and revenues that folks lost out on. So as we look forward, you know, there's a stimulus package being discussed in DC right now. We would hope that the fishing industry would be looked at kind of on par with Big Ag. You know, Big Ag, I think in the original CARES Act got $18 billion, whereas, you know, fisheries got $300 million. We provide a food service. Yeah. You know, we're integral to our nation's food security as our farmers. So I would like to think and like to hope, and we've been having conversations with folks in DC about kind of leveling that playing field. So now to your question about, you know, what your listeners can do, two things really: educate themselves on why they should be picky buyers when buying seafood. all too often, I think folks become comfortable with either walking into their local fish market or walking into their local supermarket and seeing what's there and not really paying attention to where what's there was caught. And I think that's often the missing part of the equation when we're making our seafood choices, is we tend to look for what's cheap as opposed to what's local. And, you know, what is the old adage, is that good seafood isn't cheap and cheap seafood isn't good. I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but it's catchy. You know, are you going to pay more possibly for locally harvested seafood? You probably are, but that's because of the regulatory environment that we operate in. Our fleets, in order to ensure the sustainability of the fish stocks that we harvest, are under quite a bit of oversight and catch rules and things like that. So that a person is buying California caught salmon, California caught squid, they can rest assured that that seafood is harvested under the strictest of environmental concerns. And then after educating themselves on the types of fish products that are available out there, look for your local fish markets, see if there is a fisherman's market in the port and or harbor that you attend. I know Santa Barbara has it. The commercial fishermen of Santa Barbara have a Saturday or a Sunday market. There are also some community supported fisheries that are popping up and down the West Coast. You've got Get Hooked, which is in Santa Barbara. You've got folks in the Morro Bay area that are selling directly off the boat. We're starting to see more community supported fisheries in the Monterey area and Santa Cruz area. So, you know, and if you have any questions at all, drive down to the docks, talk to a commercial fisherman. They're not the evil folks that you may think of them being portrayed as. They're more than happy to talk to you and ask them questions. That's, you know, that I think that anytime that we have the ability to talk directly to consumers and tell them our stories and the things like that, I think it serves everybody. You know, it demystifies what it is we do. It kind of goes counter to some of the things that we see in the news media, that, you know, commercial fishermen are bad people that just go out and want to kill every last fish. That's the furthest thing from the truth.
That was Mike Conroy, who leads the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association, speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. We'll post links to the UCSB study on our website, kcbx.org. Lake Tahoe has finally received a measurable amount of snow, and more is forecasted for later this week. Skiers and snowboarders are heading out to hit the slopes, albeit in reduced numbers. The boost to the economy is needed, as more than 60% of it is dependent on tourism. Cap Radio's Ezra David Romero has more on a new report exploring the pandemic's impact on the Tahoe region.
When Heidi Hildrum went Christmas shopping this past weekend in South Lake Tahoe, she wasn't expecting the crowds. 10 months ago, these same stores were empty when the first pandemic stay-at-home orders began.
When I asked the owners, how are things going? They said, it's been a surprisingly busy Saturday. They were also, I think, you know, unexpectedly surprised by how many people were coming out.
Hildrum is the CEO of the Tahoe Prosperity Center, which recently analyzed the pandemic's impact on the Lake Tahoe area. The region lost around 120,000 jobs in the first few months of the pandemic.
That is the same number of jobs lost during the entire Great Recession in Lake Tahoe.
Her group is in the process of figuring out how jobs have come back. As a flood of tourists returned to the lake this summer, the economy began to rebound. That's according to South Lake Tahoe Mayor Pro Tem Devin Middlebrook.
Our businesses were able to be very creative this summer. Our restaurants expanded outdoor dining. But that being said, we have seen local businesses closing and some that will not reopen after this is all over. And that's a permanent loss to our community.
Middlebrook says the Tahoe region hasn't fully regained strength, and the second stay-at-home order is slowing down the economy. But he says the total effect of it won't be felt for weeks, if not months. In Sacramento, I'm Ezra David Romero.
The rainy season is upon Monterey County, and because of this summer's major wildfires, the season will be accompanied with a significant risk of debris flows. Michelle Loxton from our partner station KAZU reports on the many local communities at risk.
When wildfire moves across a landscape, it changes it. Soil is burned, vegetation is charred, and that's when there's a concern about debris flows.
just a cement-like slurry that can move downhill very quickly and flow like a fluid, even though it's maybe 80% solids.
That's Kevin Cooper, a retired U.S. Forest Service biologist.
And that can really move some very large boulders. It's very, very powerful. It has all this inertia and just can go right through homes and trees and everything.
Cooper led the team that looked into the potential for debris flows after the Dolan fire in the Big Sur area. He's been doing this kind of work for decades and says it's the wildfires that increase the risk for debris flows.
It drives some of the oils, waxes, and resins down into the soil where it recondenses into a kind of a waterproof layer. It's called a hydrophobic layer. And that water repellent layer can cause the rainfall that comes to flow and sheet off of that.
Cooper says soil erosion is expected under normal conditions, but is exaggerated after wildfire with up to 400 times the amount of soil loss.
Seriously, one storm of maybe 15, 20 minutes an hour, that on a dry soil, that could cause a lot of damage.
Damage that could result in loss of life. The Dolan Fire burn scar isn't the only area Monterey County is monitoring for increased risk for debris flows. Kelsey Scanlon is an emergency services planner for the county.
Water can move fairly far away from its place of origin. And so when we look at potential risks for increased storm runoff, we were really looking at 1 to 2 miles away from each of the burn scars.
Scanlon describes her job as a bit like Tetris, connecting people with resources. The county has identified over 1,300 homes within 1 mile of the burn scars of the River, Carmel, and Dolan fires. But the risks go beyond these individual homes.
There are a good portion of homes that are not listed as values at risk. But if the roadway 3 miles up is impacted, you might have to shelter in place for more than 72 hours.
For Scanlon, the risk of debris flows comes down to these tips.
If you can look up and you see a burn slope, to some degree, you're at risk. The other is that if the rain is coming down, get to high ground.
In Santa Cruz County, debris flows around the CZU Lightning Complex burn scar could affect more than 1,000 homes, mostly in the San Lorenzo Valley.
The debris flow hazard after the fire here is probably one of the most acute things that I've had to deal with in my career.
That's Jeffrey Nolan, the Santa Cruz County geologist. The county's preparations have included studying the 2018 Montecito debris flow, where more than 20 people died and over 400 structures were destroyed or damaged.
They estimated that only 25% of the people that were supposed to evacuate for the debris flows evacuated, whereas 75% of the people evacuated for the fire. We really took that to heart here.
Nolan says there's many reasons why debris flows are so dangerous and why people should heed all evacuation orders.
They're very rapid. You can't really outrun them generally. They often happen at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's pouring down rain.
He says they can sound like a jet plane flying almost overhead. But at the end of the day, debris flows need rain to kick off. It all comes down to what's in the forecast. Brian Garcia is our region's warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service.
This winter, what we're looking at due to La Nina is we're actually looking at a drier than normal winter.
Garcia says they're expecting anything between 30 and 70% of normal precipitation.
However, that said, all of the rain that we get for the winter could come in one or two storms.
Being prepared for a debris flow means following the weather forecast, knowing your zone, and signing up for emergency alerts in case an evacuation is called. It means researching the exact risks to your location and taking action in the form of clearing out culverts or getting sandbags. And this isn't a short-term risk. Vegetation and soils can take a long time to recover after a fire, meaning there's a possibility of debris flows locally for the next 3 to 5 years. Michelle Loxton, KEZU News.
Next, we check in with our partner station, Valley Public Radio, to hear about how the coronavirus is taking a toll in the Central Valley.
For some families, COVID-19 has been ruthless, affecting many generations, from grandparents to grandchildren. FM89's news director Alice Daniels spoke with one family in Parlier whose members were in 4 different hospitals all at the same time. Brianna Cisneros is the youngest of four siblings.
I'm 9 years old.
She's sitting at a picnic table in her backyard with her two sisters, her brother, and her father. A dog barks nearby. There's music playing from a neighbor's house down the street. Signs of normalcy in a not-so-normal year. In the span of about a week back in July, Brianna's parents and her oldest sister were all sick with COVID in different hospitals in the valley. And that same week, her grandparents both died of the virus in a hospital in Los Angeles. They lived in Parlier, but were in LA when they got sick.
I was really close to them. My grandma would always take me to the park. She would take care of me, take me and my brother and sometimes my sister to the bus stop.
She misses them. And when she thinks back to that horrible week this past summer, well, it's something she's still trying to make sense of.
It's scary for someone small to think about something big, you know, that happened.
Something big that happened. It's what the whole family has been thinking about, especially now around the holidays. It's unclear how they contracted the virus. They wore masks, they say, and were careful. But they want to share their story so that others will stay vigilant and won't experience the pain they did.
I cried every day, every night.
That's Brianna's oldest sister, Jeanette. She's 23, and she's describing what it was like to be by herself at Clovis Community Medical Center with COVID, knowing that her parents and grandparents were also sick with the virus in other hospitals.
It was very, very difficult for me, and all by yourself, and sorry. It was really, really difficult.
She didn't even know she had COVID when she came to the hospital. She was there to have a baby, and she was tested for the virus.
And a few hours after is when I started having a fever, shortness of breath, chills, headache.
She says labor was especially difficult because she was having so much trouble just breathing. After her son David was born, nurses asked Jeanette's husband to bring him home. Jeanette stayed for several more days because she was so sick.
Doctor called me, was saying, your daughter's sick.
That's Rodolfo Cisneros. When Jeanette's doctor called him, Rodolfo was also in a hospital with COVID, an hour away in Hanford. His wife, meanwhile, had been transferred to a hospital in Lodi. All Rodolfo could do was ask the doctor to take good care of his daughter.
Please, you know, take care of him because, you know, I am in the hospital too.
He says he lost 20 pounds and, like Jeanette, required oxygen. At one point, he was worried for his life.
He was scary. I was thinking bad. I mean, what's going to happen to me?
Meanwhile, the three kids still at home struggled to keep everything together. They say they each had minor symptoms of COVID, like headaches, but were never tested. To stay in touch with his parents, 15-year-old Rodolfo Jr. says technology helped, but it also made him anxious.
You could text your parents anytime you want, and I would get worried when they wouldn't answer.
19-year-old Valeria says the uncertainty of that week was awful.
So hard because, I mean, I saw everyone like leaving the hospital, and I tried to be strong for my siblings too.
When their grandparents died, the kids were alone.
My family and I agreed to not tell my parents and my sister yet because they were both not doing well. And so we kind of had to grieve by ourselves.
And as COVID cases spike in the valley, it's something she hopes other families are able to avoid. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
Next, Around Downtown, host Bettina Swigger talks with Stephanie Stackhouse of Slow Yoga Studios about current challenges and opportunities and the risks her family took during the pandemic to help their business stay vital.
This is Bettina Swigger for KCBX Issues and Ideas with our monthly program called Around Downtown, where we talk about a variety of issues facing the downtowns in our Central Coast area. In addition to being your KCBX radio host, I am also the CEO of Downtown Slow. And for today's guest, I have Stephanie Stackhouse, who is the co-owner of Slow Yoga Studios. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thanks, Bettina.
So I'm really interested in talking to you today because you have a unique perspective as a business owner who operates a wellness business during a pandemic, and also somebody who has opened a new space, a new retail space in downtown San Luis Obispo. So can you tell us a little bit about what your daily life looks like?
It is kind of a whirlwind and consists of so many different activities right now. You know, back in March when we shut down, we had Slow Yoga Center we're operating as a wellness studio, offering yoga and fitness classes in our studios. And so when we had to close down, we quickly launched online classes. So we recorded some classes, and then we also started using Zoom for doing live stream classes. It was a quick pivot, like so many other businesses were doing, to get those up and running. And so all the technology sort of hurdles of how do you make sure that people can hear you, see you? How do you get links to people as they're signing up for class? All those different components. It was very much manual effort in the beginning, and now we've kind of streamlined it as best we can using technology. And then we had a couple of, you know, opportunities in the midst of the past 9-10 months to reopen and hold in studio classes for a brief stint in July. And then another more recent in, October, November. And so that was a matter of, okay, how do we then get back into the studio? But we had a lot of our members that weren't comfortable coming back in yet. So live stream classes are here to stay. So then it was another matter of how do we get our studios outfitted with the proper technology, mics, cameras, to be able to provide, again, live stream classes over Zoom that people could see and they could hear, and they could continue their practice from the safety of their home if that was best for them. A daily life, it's sort of troubleshooting, helping to fix an audio issue or that type of things, sort of keeping pace with the ever-changing guidelines that are coming out from the state and trying to make sense of those. And also just, you know, staying in communication with our members, best of all, because like you said, we're a wellness business. And through this pandemic, really attending each of us to our own physical and mental well-being is essential to get through this time. It's so complex and challenging and dynamic that the more that we can all take time out to sort of rest, get grounded, breathe, the better. You know, for us, we've really been pushing, even at the state level, that really coming out of this, a greater focus on the education importance of attending to your physical and mental well-being. Our hope is that that becomes more of a focus at a broader level.
What kind of people are your members these days?
So we've definitely, like so many other small businesses, seen a big contraction, you know, as people themselves have been laid off, furloughed, you know, lost their job in any number of different ways. We've lost a lot of members, and a lot of that happened in the first 6 months. Also, when we had sort of opening for a little bit and then closing for a little bit, we saw members leave and just really couldn't afford it anymore. And we also saw a lot of people that sort of left the area. So we've seen a contraction of our business for sure overall, but we have actually had some new people join us. We've been throughout this whole thing doing outdoor classes. And so in addition to our live stream classes that we have, we do about, I think, 3 classes a week right now outside. And on Sundays, we do them at Emerson Park near downtown, where the Parks and Rec office is. And that's part of the Open Slow program through the city. They've really been helpful with doing fitness in the park sort of programs and supporting wellness businesses locally. So we've been offering a community class every Sunday morning. So community class is one where it's free, but it's like, hey, come out and practice in the park. We can distance from each other. And it's interesting because I've had a few people that have come up and told me that they had always wanted to try yoga, but they didn't feel comfortable coming into a studio. A lot of people are really not into the online component because maybe they have kids running around at home, or they don't have the right setup, or they're on Zoom all day long. So they really don't want to do that for their practice. So we've had some people that have come and joined us in the park that have then become members because, like I said, they'd always wanted to try yoga, but they really didn't feel comfortable coming in. The consistent reason was that they felt like people would be looking at them and kind of judging if they were doing things right or wrong. So being outside in the park sort of eliminated that worry of anyone's in particular looking at me. And it has been just a game changer for them. And now it's just a regular part of their life that they have said they're going to continue. So I love that because it, you know, even through this time of the contraction of our business, of people losing jobs, of having these challenges, there are these little bright spots of, you know, the discovery of yoga for some people because they were able to do it outside. And I think that's something that we'll continue to do long term in addition to the live stream and in studio is an outdoor class too, because we are so lucky on the Central Coast to have nice weather that allows that almost year round.
And you've advocated for outdoor yoga programs before. I believe you've done some yoga in the Mission Plaza in the downtown.
My hope is, you know, the city, like I said, they've been really supportive through this pandemic of streamlining and making that process really easy. I can tell you in the past when we have done big public classes like in Mission Plaza, it hasn't been super easy. There's sort of a lot of paperwork to fill out and hoops to jump through, and it can be expensive. And so my hope is that, yeah, in partnership with the city or maybe some other places, that we could continue this outdoor component.
You also expanded your downtown studio, and in a time when retail, of course, is having a little bit of a challenging moment and was before the pandemic. Talk to us a little bit about what your decision path was toward opening and expanding your presence in downtown San Luis Obispo.
I mean, if you had asked me in January if I ever planned to open a retail store, I would have said, no, never. But here I am. It definitely came out of the location that we are in downtown. We're in a 3-story building and previously occupied the second and third floor of the building for our yoga studio. And the retail store on the ground level did close in July. And we had always thought, you know, if the opportunity came about that we could move into that ground floor space, that we would really love to, because we wanted to have an accessible space, basically a place where people didn't have to go upstairs if they wanted to do yoga, and for us to be able to offer something like chair yoga for people that are wheelchair bound or have mobility issues. And so when that space became available, we sort of quickly evaluated, well, you know, this timing is less than ideal given that we're in the middle of this pandemic, but I've always been opportunistic and sort of thinking through, you know, when something becomes available, would this make sense? How would this make sense? And so we decided two things. One, we could achieve that sort of desire that we had to have an accessible studio space, and also be able to diversify our business in a way that would allow us to get sales from other areas, and that being retail. So we put in a very small studio space in the back of the ground floor. That's our accessible studio. And most of the ground floor is a retail space. And it's been a very steep learning curve, something that I've been able to do with my 18-year-old daughter, which has also just been such a wonderful experience for us to do this in partnership. And wow. So that was an incredible undertaking, but something that we're really proud of. We love the space. It has been a way that some of our members that we haven't seen in months have come in, and we've been able to catch up with them a little bit. And it's nice to have that ability to still see people and, from a business perspective, still be able to earn some revenue in a space that we've been paying rent for throughout this entire thing.
Definitely an agile response to a difficult situation. You mentioned that you've been working on the retail space with your daughter, and Flow Yoga Center is a family business, correct?
Yes. I mean, thank goodness it's a family-run business. And we have to remind our daughters of that all the time, that everybody's got to work at the business. And yeah, my husband and I both teach classes. He manages most of the facilities. I do sort of the operations and marketing side. And my older daughter does our social media. And then we have a 9-year-old. She's in fourth grade. And she is involved with our kids yoga classes. We're also doing kids yoga, I should mention, in the park. So she'll play ukulele while the kids are in Shavasana, and it's just the most adorable thing ever. So it's so special. I love it. I love that they sort of get to grow up and feel very much involved in the business and see firsthand what it takes to be that entrepreneur, that small business owner, to just have that endurance, perseverance, keep going, keep showing up that is required. And they are so helpful in their different ways. So they feel like they have a sense of ownership in the business.
Well, that's great. And how wonderful that downtown is their backyard. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today, Steph. We really appreciate it. And thanks for sharing your perspective.
Yeah, thank you.
That was contributor Bettina Swigger talking with Slow Yoga Studios' Stephanie Stackhouse on our monthly segment, Around Downtown. Since tragedy struck there in September of 2019, for many, the Channel Islands lately are associated with the Conception dive boat fire, when 34 people lost their lives. But there are many more facets to the national park off the Central Coast. Jacob Siegel Briel is the co-founder and senior editor at Petalborn Pictures. The production company just created a new project called Island Visions. And Siegel Briel spoke with KCBX's Greta Mart about the book and the wonderland it aims to capture. And just a note that campgrounds on the islands are temporarily closed due to the current COVID-19 restrictions.
Tell me about the book. What is it? You called it an un-textbook.
So Island Visions started out of an educational program that we were working on with Santa Barbara Middle School, which is where my brother and illustrator Isaac and I both went to school. And they'd been taking their school out to the Channel Islands for over a decade, exposing the kids to the wonder and incredible just ways to see nature that are out there. And there'd always been this desire to share some of that magic with folks on the mainland, especially kids who might not get a chance to get out to the islands, because I think a lot of us who grew up in Southern California, you see them on the horizon, and it's just sort of this place that's out there that's a little mysterious. You don't really know what's going on. And then you learn that it's a national park that's been compared to people call it North America's Galapagos. It's just full of all these amazing creatures and stories that really bring our relationship with the planet to life. And so the school had been looking to share that experience. And as filmmakers and storytellers, we jumped at the opportunity to be a part of that. And from the outset recognized that there are all these amazing people who interact with the islands on a daily basis, whether they're Chumash elders or fishermen or park rangers or marine biologists, who can speak to what's so cool about this place in such a unique way that we as filmmakers and writers and illustrators couldn't necessarily capture if we were to write something that was from a third person narrator's perspective. And so we wanted to kind of flip this idea of a textbook or an informational science book on its head and gather together stories from all of these amazing experts of all walks of life and have them be the teachers. And we sort of weave their stories together with a little bit of editorial interlude and illustration. And that's why we came upon the idea of an untextbook, because we felt like that was the best way to describe what we were trying to do with this project.
Very cool. Okay, it sounds neat. Now, like when you see this book out in the world, where do you see it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it definitely started primarily as an educational project. It was partially inspired by a filmmaker named Mike Degree, who was a mentor of ours, who was amazing ocean camera operator for decades, worked with James Cameron on projects, did stuff for National Geographic. And he was sort of always pointing to the islands as this amazing outdoor classroom. And so inspired by him, he actually passed away in a helicopter crash while scouting for a project in 2012. And that was sort of another impetus for this project. And so we wanted to share this initially with classrooms, and we're still definitely doing that, working on getting the book out to teachers who are looking for something that provides a little bit of both local and story-based context for a lot of everything from social studies to marine biology. I think it definitely, lessons resonate with kids when there is a place or a person that's either local or they can empathize with. It really brings that content to light, especially when you're talking about big, difficult issues like ocean acidification or plastics or overfishing. They can be really abstract if you don't have a single person or place or fish that can, you know, draw you in and make it seem relevant. And so we're working on getting the book out to educators. And also, as we sort of started sharing early copies of the book with folks, quickly realized that the students who we were targeting weren't all students in the classroom, and that students of all ages is kind of a catch-all that we've embraced, and that I think this book is just as at home on a desk as it is on a beach blanket or a coffee table or in your backyard or out on a hike. And we really want to inspire that same sense of wonder both in the classroom and outside of it. So we're working on getting it into local bookstores and museums when they reopen, surf shops, dive shops. We're selling it online as well through our publishing partner, maps.com. And if there are any teachers out there who want to use it in their classrooms, they're welcome to reach out to us directly, jacob@pedalbornpictures.com. And then we've got an Instagram page for the book where we're previewing content that's Island Visions, the book. And folks are welcome to reach out, and we'd be happy to share. And so it's kind of trying to get it out to any and all people who are looking for a little bit of backyard wonder, of stories of California that they may not have heard before, but are incredibly local and relevant. Even if you're, you know, anywhere on the coast, there's a lot of stuff that's out at the islands that's really just a jumping off point to understanding our relationship with the ocean.
Okay, got it. All righty. And so working on this project, what was the coolest thing you've experienced out at the Channel Islands?
Oh, man, so many. We went out when we were ninth graders back in the day, when we were at Santa Barbara Middle School, and have gone out probably, a dozen times since then. And every time there's something new. I mean, whether it's, I remember one time we were out and saw a pod of orcas, which is kind of crazy to think of orcas in Southern California, but they're definitely there. And we've seen dolphins surf the bow of the boat before, but to see a family of orcas surfing the bow of your boat is pretty amazing. And I was filming it, and they were blowing air out when they came up for a breath. And it was at sunset, and they were literally blowing rainbows, because that's the way the light caught the water. And it was just this surreal experience of orcas surfing the boat of your bow of your boat, blowing rainbows. It sounds like a, you know, something out of a movie, but little things like that just happen out there. I remember there's another time that the captain of the boat took us over in a skiff and told us to just dip our heads under the water. And we didn't really know what to expect. And I don't know how he intuited this, but there was this like tornado of sea lions underneath our skiff who just like, as soon as they saw us there, they're these incredibly playful and weirdly human creatures. I mean, they just came up and were blowing bubbles at us. And I mean, it kind of freaked us out because I'd never been that, you know, up close and personal with another creature that is very wild, but is also very human. And they were clearly playing and like wanted to check us out just as much as we were checking them out, and, you know, definitely kept our distance. But yeah, just the humanity of nature is a weird way to put it, but the connection that I think you get out there with all of these amazing creatures is really powerful and kind of mind-blowing, given that these islands are, you know, 20 miles off the coast of one of the most populated parts of the United States, which I think is part of what makes them so amazing.
You said, you know, you've been out there a dozen times. That's a lot. And you started going as a kid on like school trips. I mean, how would somebody who comes from like a low income family, you know, how would somebody actually get themselves out there if they didn't have the resources like through a school? And
yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that there's a lot of organizations that are doing some really incredible work, especially to get kids from lower income neighborhoods out there. The main access point to the Channel Islands right now is through Island Packers out of the Ventura Harbor. They run all of the ferries out there and have incredible naturalists on board. And it's not, I mean, resources are still a thing. It still costs to go out, but you know, for what you get for a relatively affordable ferry ticket, I mean, it's cheaper than going to Disneyland. And I would argue you get a heck of a lot more incredible enjoyment out of it. Anybody can go hop on one of their boats and they go out to various islands on various schedules. So I highly encourage folks to do that. I think it's something that a lot of people don't realize any member of the public can do. You just go to their website and book a ferry ticket. And then, yeah, I know schools right now aren't going out as much, but a lot of schools do take students out there. And there's groups like the Marito Foundation down in Ventura and Oxnard that's working really hard to get low-income kids out to the islands. Because I think talking to educators, one of the things that's really interesting is that, especially in Southern California, in lower-income communities, they'll be, you know, sharing a biology textbook and it'll use the Everglades or Yosemite as an example of incredible biodiversity. And for a kid in Southern California who maybe hasn't even been to the beach, it's so abstract and hard to grasp. And so I think showing kids that there's this place that's an amazing national park that holds so much beauty and wonder that's right there and in our communities can really help bring the idea of our connectedness to this planet alive and, you know, hopefully spark some future scientists among kids who never thought that that was something that they could do.
I too did not know that you could book a ferry. I thought you had to get some kind of special permit to spend the night or camp or you are these day trips that go out?
Yeah, there's a mix of both. So the majority of the four northern islands is a national park. Half of Santa Cruz Island, the biggest island, is run by the Nature Conservancy. And you do have to get a permit if you want to go there, although it's possible. Anybody can apply for a permit. But to visit the national park, you don't need a permit. You just need the ferry ticket. It's a national park, so it's free once you get out there. There's two campgrounds on Santa Cruz and one on Santa Rosa where you can spend the night and you reserve a campsite just like you would in any other national park. And the boat drops you off. Some of them have running water, some of them don't. So, you know, it depends on how rugged and remote you want to get. But yeah, it's kind of crazy that there's this huge national park out there that, you know, it's the biggest one that's in close access for most of Southern California, but, you know, gets a fraction of the number of visitors of Yosemite or Kings Canyon or Sequoia, which are also amazing places, not to bash them. But yeah. We hope with this book it gets more people to just look off the horizon a little bit and go check it out.
That was Jacob Siegel Briel speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart about a new project focused on the Channel Islands called Island Visions. And just a note that campgrounds on the islands are temporarily closed due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. kcbx.org.